The PFD application is open. Just a small amount of your PFD will help share local news and stories about Alaskans with Alaskans across this great state when you choose Alaska Public Media through Pick, Click, Give.
We trusted the process, trusted the government, trusted the courts, because we followed the paperwork.
Soldotna man reckons with his family's deportation. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, February 27th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, the Alaska House passes a ban on AI-generated child sexual abuse material.
Anything that is generated obscene material of minors will be criminalized to the same level as if it were a real child.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Hi, I'm Avery Elfelt, a reporter with the Alaska Desk. That's a joint reporting effort from Alaska Public Media, KHNS, where I work in Haines, and other public radio stations in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and the Aleutians. It allows us to connect you with the issues happening in communities all across the state. You can hear our stories during the morning news on Alaska News Nightly or online at alaskapublic.org. The Alaska Desk is only possible with the support of grants and listeners like you. Thank you.
It's been about a week since federal Immigration Customs Enforcement agents descended on a Soldotna home to deport a mom and her children to Mexico. In the days since, community members, faith leaders, and state lawmakers have all jumped into action to support the family amid their uncertain future. KDLL's Ashlyn O'Hara reports.
It's close to midnight in Soldotna's Safeway lobby, and Alex Sanchez Ramos is between shifts of his two jobs, still in his first work uniform. His wife, Sonia Espinosa Arriaga, is on speakerphone, calling from Mexico.
I said that it was very difficult to watch, just sitting there in the car, and she thought that there, as long as it would take in to pack some things, she started getting a little bit of hope that it felt like it was just her going, because why would they put a kid, children, in handcuffs and detain them like that?
An ICE spokesperson says the agency kept them together at the mom's request, up until ICE handed the oldest son off to a state jail in Anchorage to be processed as an adult. Arriaga and her two younger sons were put on a plane and deported.
And that's when she realized they were misled, and Alexi was gone.
Alexis is the oldest son, who was 18.
And she didn't understand where he was or where they went. And they told her he'll be here later on. And totally misleading the whole time.
As of Wednesday, Alexis remains detained in ICE's Tacoma, Washington Detention Center, according to ICE's Detainee Locator Database. It's unclear what awaits him. Sanchez Ramos, a lifelong Alaskan and U.S. citizen, says it all started with an immigration hearing his wife missed on January 13th. 2 days later, a letter arrived with a deportation order. The couple contacted their lawyer, who outlined steps to rectify the error. They thought they had everything squared away.
We trusted the process, trusted the government, trusted the courts, because we followed the paperwork. And when your attorney says, don't worry, it's going to be okay because follow the paperwork, this is what's going to happen. Because that's what happens in her case, and, you know, from her experience, obviously.
Espinosa Arriaga and her three sons arrived in the United States in 2023, seeking asylum from cartel violence and domestic abuse. While their asylum case moved forward, she and her two older sons got work authorization cards. The youngest, Matias, is 5 years old, a kindergartner. Faith leaders told reporters they have no criminal records. The couple met in Soldotna. Sanchez Ramos gravitated toward Espinosa Arriaga's funny personality and awesome laugh.
Una risa bien bonita y también tienes una actitud.
Espinosa Arriaga points out his good looks and positive attitude at work. And she says he got along with her kids. Their deportation has outraged friends, coworkers, acquaintances, and strangers across Alaska. Susan Abholtz, a former Kenai Peninsula Borough School District teacher, remembers one of the boys from her class.
It just makes me sick to think that all of a sudden all of that was just pulled out from under them.
Nabholz was one of more than 100 people who gathered at Soldatenes Christ Lutheran Church last Friday to support the family. Faith leaders think this is the first time ICE has ever detained children in Alaska. As of Wednesday, a GoFundMe for the family had raised more than $15,000 for legal fees and to help Espinosa Arriaga and her kids start over in Mexico. The couple says they're grateful. State lawmakers on the House Judiciary Committee met to review ICE's detention of minors in Alaska. One immigration law expert told the committee she was shocked at how quickly the family was deported.
As I understand the facts, this family didn't have an opportunity to contest the removal order against at least one family member because they were so swiftly and abruptly deported from the United States.
Alora Mukherjee directs the Immigrants' Rights Clinic at Columbia Law School.
This is not what due process requires. This is not what the Constitution allows. This family should have had an opportunity to be heard on whatever claim the U.S. government, the executive branch, is making against them.
Mukherjee says there are lawful reasons to miss an immigration hearing, like misdirected mail or a medical emergency. In Mexico, it's been violent since the Mexican government killed the head of a powerful drug cartel on Sunday. In messages to KDLL sent via TikTok, Christopher, the middle son, says he's scared and that he misses his girlfriend back in Soldatna. Here he is in one video, thanking people who have reached out.
I don't want me here. This is... Thank you so much. You guys helped me so much. I just want to go back to my life.
Sanchez Ramos says his goal is to bring his family back to Alaska. Their attorney couldn't be reached for comment, but is challenging the family's detention in federal court. For now, Sanchez Ramos is trying to do what he can for Alexis in Tacoma, and says he's trying to renew his passport to visit the others in Mexico.
And it's so empty without Sonia there and the children, and I miss them so much.
Now, he goes home to a yard with a melting snowman he built with Matias and a quiet house. Reporting in Soldatna, I'm Ashlyn O'Hara.
The Alaska House unanimously passed a prohibition on AI-generated child sexual abuse material today. The bill is a longtime priority for a conservative Homer lawmaker, but as Alaska Public Media's Eric Stone reports, lawmakers vastly expanded the scope of the bill just before passing it, including provisions that would severely limit children's access to social media.
The bill started with a simple concept: to update state laws against child sexual abuse material, what used to be called child pornography, to cover images created with artificial intelligence. Homer Republican Representative Sarah Vance brought the bill forward.
Currently in statute, you have to prove the harm of an actual child. And what this bill does is says that anything that is generated obscene material of minors will be criminalized to the same level as if it were a real child.
And it had broad bipartisan support. Here's Representative Andrew Gray, an Anchorage Democrat who chairs the House Judiciary Committee.
You know, the bottom line is that AI has moving forward at lightning speed. Alaska is behind the curveball. We really need guardrails as quickly as possible to protect children first and foremost, but all of us.
All of us. Thanks to a series of amendments from Democratic Anchorage Representative Zach Fields and one from another majority member, the bill that passed the House expanded rapidly. The newest version also makes it a crime to create AI-generated sexual images of adults. Here's Fields.
I agree with the underlying bill. I also don't think that perverts should be able to create obscene sexual material about a 19-year-old.
But another addition to the bill drew some significant bipartisan pushback, an expansive package restricting children's use of social media. And it covers a lot. Anyone under 18 in Alaska would need permission from a parent or guardian to sign up for an account on a social platform, and they'd have a 10:30 p.m. social media curfew by default. It would also prevent platforms from advertising to minors or using any algorithm to feed them content based on who they are or their interests. Field says it's a public safety issue. He points to the recent arrest of a legislative staffer accused of enticing and exploiting children via Snapchat, and he says it's an effort to reduce social media's company's influence on children.
I think the fundamental question with this amendment is, do parental rights supersede the rights of predators, and do parental rights supersede the right of multinational corporations, which, as we have heard, knowingly target children with addictive, destructive algorithms?
Field says he takes inspiration from a similar proposal in Utah. More than a dozen states have passed versions of what Fields proposed, though some have faced significant legal challenges from the tech industry. The idea drew criticism from across the political spectrum. Some lawmakers raised privacy issues, like how do you tell if someone is over 18 and that they're someone's parents? Others said the restrictions could be easily bypassed. Representative Dan Sadler, an Eagle River Republican, said he was worried the broad package of regulations could lead the bill to stall as it heads to the Senate.
If I could cast a single vote, make all these things happen to be law and be effective, I would do it in a heartbeat twice if I could. But I fear that this is such a large issue that it imperils bogging down the rest of the good work that's in this bill.
And it wouldn't be the first time. In 2024, a bill that would have required pornographic websites to verify users' ages stalled in the Senate after House lawmakers added restrictions on children's use of social media. But Vance, the original sponsor, says she's not too worried. She was one of a chorus of House lawmakers on Friday who called on the Senate to fine-tune the bill before passing it into law. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Eric Stone.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an unlikely trio becomes a crowd favorite at this year's Iron Dog Snow Machine Race.
I think all of us thought we were a little too old for the adventure racing, but we liked the riding. When we got the opportunity to come here, we couldn't pass it up.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
I'm Shelby Herbert, a reporter with the Alaska Desk. That's a joint reporting effort from Alaska Public Media and KUAC, where I work in Fairbanks, and other public radio stations in Anchorage, Haines, and the Aleutians. It allows us to connect you with the issues happening in communities all across the state. You can hear our stories during the morning news, Alaska News Nightly, or online at alaskapublic.org. The Alaska Desk is only possible with the support of grants and listeners like you. Thank you.
Crews are about halfway done removing a colossal drilling rig that toppled over on the North Slope. State on-scene coordinator Kimberly Marr says the first focus was on spilled fluids, and now they're also dismantling the structure.
Right now, there's ice roads that have been constructed in place that heavy equipment can work from. And so as of this afternoon, they've removed about 47% of the rig.
Marr, who works for the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation, spoke Thursday. The rig is called Doyon 26 and nicknamed the Beast. It was as tall as a 15-story building and fell a month ago while it was in transit. Marr says the salvage operation is on track to be finished by spring breakup. She says slightly more than half of the estimated 4,600 gallons of diesel and hydraulic fluids that spilled have been recovered so far. The site is 6 miles northwest of the community of Nuiqsut. Marr says it's about 500 feet from streams.
Fortunately, this happened while everything is very frozen, and so we will be continuing to monitor the site, delineate the contamination, and put tactics in place to minimize any potential of contamination hitting any waterways.
ConocoPhillips expected to use Doyon 26 in its exploration of the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. It is continuing that work with other equipment. Earth Justice attorney Ian Dooley filed a lawsuit over the work in the reserve. He says the rig accident is emblematic of the problems people in Nuiqsut have had.
There's a lack of safety, there's a lack of oversight, there's a lack of accountability that is going along with the oil and gas projects that are occurring in this area. And there is at least some deep concern by community members that their safety is not being duly considered.
The cleanup is a joint operation of Doyon Drilling, federal and state agencies, the North Slope Borough, and the Inupiat Community of the Arctic Slope, a tribal government representing Nuiqsut and 7 other villages. The Matanuska-Susitna Borough School District, like others around the state, is facing a budget shortfall and making some tough decisions about what to cut. So far, the proposed cuts include closing 3 schools ahead of next school year. But as the Matsu Sentinel reports, that's not going to be enough to make up the roughly $23 million gap, and there will likely be more cuts on the table, potentially to staff and programs. Separately, the Union for School Bus Drivers in the Matsu is set to strike Monday amid an impasse in contract negotiations. The Matsu Sentinel's Amy Bouchatz says, similar to other districts, Matsu schools have suffered from stagnant state funding and declining enrollment. But unlike other parts of the state, the Matsu borough's population isn't shrinking.
Matsu isn't necessarily losing population, right? We always hear that they're gaining population. But one, let's remember that a rising population does not necessarily translate to a rising population of people ages 5 to 18. But really, the difference here is that how Mat-Su is losing students is to other school districts as those students enroll in homeschool correspondence programs run by those other school districts. And so students who live in Mat-Su don't have to enroll in Mat-Su school district. They can enroll in those other districts' homeschool programs, and they do.
Gotcha. So as you reported at matsusentinel.com, there are some schools that are slated for closure. Tell us about those schools. Why are those the ones that are being proposed to be closed? And then are there other cuts as well kind of on the table?
Yeah. So this week, the school district announced that Larson and Meadow Lakes Elementary Schools, which are both near Wasilla, and Glacier View School, which serves kids kindergarten through 12th grade in Glacier View, are being targeted because district officials say they have falling enrollment and that they are schools that can have their students sent other places, in specifically in the case of Larson and Meadow Lakes. That's a little bit less true for Glacier View. Certainly, Glacier View's enrollment is falling, but sending your kid some other place when you are in Glacier View is a big deal. And so those kids will have to be bused 40 miles to Sutton Elementary School, or if they're secondary students, into Palmer for Palmer Junior Middle School or Palmer High School.
Yeah, and I want to ask you about the bus situation kind of here more in the near term. But what have you heard from parents about these proposals to close these schools?
Well, parents are really upset. You know, closing a school is a really emotional thing. I think anybody who's had kids enrolled in a school feels an emotional tie to that facility where your children spend all of that time. Larson and Meadow Lakes both have special needs programs that people feel very strongly about. Parents from these schools are expecting to participate in the school board meeting this week. There is a Save Our School rally planned at Larson Elementary for Monday evening, planned by the Parent Teacher Association. And so folks are really upset about, and teachers and the, you know, staff at these schools are really upset about the schools being targeted for closure.
And then just so I'm clear on this, is it just school closures, or are there other programs or even, you know, positions, including teachers, I guess, that might be cut here?
Yeah. So $23 million is not going to be made up with three school closures. The way the math works on these school closures is actually very interesting. A school costs about $5 million to run, but closing it only saves 1.5. And that's because, of course, the students don't go away, right? The students are now being sent to another school. The staff in that new school has to be plussed up. The services that those students are using still exist. So between those three schools, you're looking at a $4.5 million savings. Where's the other money coming from? Well, the school district is going to introduce their proposal for the rest of those cuts next week. They basically said, hey, we're going to present on this on Wednesday. We'll see you then.
Sounds like the calculus on all of that is still ongoing. And of course, like you said, they're making plans for the next school year. But then more immediately, as we alluded to, there are some transportation issues that may be coming up a lot sooner, in that there is potentially going to be a bus strike here pretty soon.
So the contract standstill is sort of, it depends on who you ask. The union says that this is about paid cancellation days, wages, and professional development, safety, and whether workers must pay out of pocket for additional medical screenings. While the bus contractor, Durham, says that this is about wages, that the bus contractors are asking too much, and over healthcare premiums, which the bus contractor, Durham, says that they are doing and that the bus workers want more. So, you know, it's like any contract negotiation. It's very tense, and it's a labor issue.
That was Amy Bouchatz with the Mat-Su Sentinel, which you can find at matsusentinel.com. Hunting and fishing are deeply rooted in Alaska's culture. Yet when political candidates face off, it's surprising how few of the debate questions focus on fish and game. But this Saturday, the Alaska Outdoor Council aims to change that. As KNBA's Rhonda McBride reports, the Sport Hunting and Fishing Advocacy Group is hosting its first ever governor's debate.
The Alaska Outdoor Council's director says this election, more so than others in the past, really matters.
They're some of the biggest conservation issues of our lifetime.
Also big for Caleb Martin, how to handle a debate with 17 candidates. Rather than wrestle with an unwieldy forum, Martin says debate organizers let their members narrow the field. Based on a survey, they were asked to choose 6 candidates to appear in the debate. Campaign contributions and social media following were also factored in. The 6 candidates that made the cut in alphabetical order are former State Senator Clegg Bishop, former Anchorage Mayor Dave Bronson, former State Revenue Commissioner Adam Crom, Matt Halala, a podiatrist and business owner, former State Senator Shelley Hughes, and Bernadette Wilson, a longtime conservative activist. That leaves 6 Republicans, 3 Democrats, and 2 independents out of the mix. And Martin says that's okay, because the process of selecting the candidates was democratic.
Our real focus right now is to get the outdoor community involved, because there's some very, very big issues facing Alaska with the decline in Chinook salmon, trawler bycatch issues, caribou decline.
Martin says candidates selected for this debate should not be considered an endorsement. That will come later, he says, and all the candidates have been asked to state their positions in an extensive survey, which will be distributed to its members, including one from former State Senator Tom Begich, who came less than 1% of a percentage point from securing a spot in the debate. Begich says he'll fill out the survey, but is disappointed that the forum will only hear views from a conservative slice of the candidates, which he believes is a disservice to the council's members.
If you want to fully inform your members, you should inform them not just of the positions you like, but maybe even of the ones you might be uncomfortable with.
But how do you effectively juggle 17 voices in a debate? James Brooks, a political reporter for the Alaska Beacon, says that's a good question with no easy answers.
I was just at a forum that had all but 2 of the Republican candidates. And giving each candidate 30 seconds to answer doesn't really allow people to dive into policy, doesn't allow you to touch more than the surface.
Over the years, Brooks has covered dozens of debates in political forums and says in this year's governor's race, debate hosts like the Alaska Outdoor Council have to weigh some difficult trade-offs.
As a private group, they're allowed to invite whoever they want to it. I do think that the most informed debates, the most informed panels are going to be those that present a variety of issues.
Brooks says the candidates invited to this Saturday's forum have mostly similar views on the budget and the permanent fund dividend, with the exception of Clegg Bishop. So the focus on fish and game issues may help some of the candidates pull away from the pack. And while hunting and fishing policy rarely gets a lot of bandwidth in most candidate debates, Brooks says this political season is shaping up to be different, with a myriad of issues that put access to land, fish, and game in the spotlight. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
Three men with Minnesota roots became unlikely crowd favorites in this year's Iron Dog Snow Machine race. It wasn't from setting any course records. The trio raced for the non-competitive Ambassador team. But as KNOM's Quinn White tells us, something else set the trio apart from the rest of the field.
It's hard to miss the white-haired riders in the Iron Dog's Ambassador class.
Got the name of the three old guys, which we are capable of that name.
That's 75-year-old Paul Dick, one-third of the group known as the Three Old Guys. His partner, 68-year-old Rob Hellstrom, says their racing days are behind them, but they couldn't resist one more chance to be on the trail together.
I think all of us thought we were a little too old for the adventure racing, but we liked the riding. When we got the opportunity to come here, we couldn't pass it up.
Rounding out the trio is 72-year-old Rex Hibbert. When it comes to long-haul snow machine expeditions, Dick says this isn't their first rodeo.
A few years back, we went from me and us three, me and Rob and Rex went from Minnesota up to Churchill, and then they thought, hey, that was kind of fun, so maybe we'll just go another trip.
After circling Canada's east coast, Hallstrom says they headed north.
When we rode up to Alaska here, it was almost entirely off trail, up the Mackenzie River, through the Richardson Mountains, down the Porcupine River. Really enjoyed it, but very physical, lots of trail breaking. We lost a lot of weight on that trip, 39 days on the trail.
With thousands of miles already under their belts, the three old guys thought the Iron Dog would be something like a leisure ride.
It didn't quite go like that. It turned out to be a little more than we thought it would be.
This year's race was marked by a series of storms that swept through the region, with fierce winds, bitter cold temperatures, and deep snow.
We've got a lot of miles in together, so we know how to. We know what needs to be done. It's just not getting any easier. So,
taking it slow and steady, the three old guys arrived in Nome after a week on the trail. A post celebrating their arrival drew over 3,000 likes. Dick says their Facebook page, Three Old Guys Ride Across North America, started in 2022 as a way to keep their families up to date on their adventures. Now, over 50,000 people follow the page.
I don't know how that got so blown out of proportion, but it sure did, you know, that people, I think a lot of people feel sorry for us, I think. You know, when you go in some place, they say, these guys are a bubble off, you know.
Dick says this will be the three old guys' last ride together. Probably.
I got a caller ID in my phone, and if it rings out from here, I don't know. Yeah, you want to go to Nome? Yeah, we want to go here, so we don't know. You know? So we might have to have a divorce. You know, it won't be a muddy one, but it'll be a divorce, you know.
Reporting in Nome, I'm Quinn White.
And that is all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Ashlyn O'Hara in Soldotna, Eric Stone in Juneau, Liz Ruskin and Rhonda McBride in Anchorage, and Quinn White in Nome. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Crystal Hyde, Kirsten Dobroth is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Have a great weekend.